On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fact-checking journalism is the heart of PolitiFact. It's a fact-checking website that rates the accuracy of claims by elected officials and others on its Truthometer. We're checking in on some of its latest digging with a Wisconsin connection. Have you heard lawmakers talk about prisons or crime or taxes and wondered whether those statements were true? What made you skeptical? What do you want to know from a reporter who investigates claims made by elected officials? We're at 800-642-1234. Eric Litke is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. Eric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been writing about a video circulating on social media that portrays former Vice President Joe Biden endorsing Donald Trump for president. Among others, it was retweeted by Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. What does former Vice President Biden appear to say in the video?
So this is a 14-second clip. It was making the rounds on March 7 after a rally that day that Biden held in Kansas City. So Biden has a few stumbles kind of to start off the video and then finishes in the video version saying, "Excuse me, we can only reelect Donald Trump." And it stops there. If we go back to the original video, however, you get a very, very different version of events. So it's actually cutting him off mid-sentence. The full sentence says, "Excuse me, we can only reelect Donald Trump if, in fact, we get engaged in this circular firing squad here." So it was ultimately a call for unity. If you look at the context before it, he talks about himself as the nominee who will bring this party together. So we have a video that's chopped off to really significantly alter it. You know, it's like if I said, "I hate my wife being gone so much," and someone chopped it off to say, "I hate my wife."
Well,
let's
hear Biden's actual remarks.
"Because we cannot get reelect, we cannot win this reelection. Excuse me, we can only reelect Donald Trump if, in fact, we get engaged in this circular firing squad here. It's got to be a positive campaign, so join us."
All right, so you can see how they could make that easy edit.
Right, and once that gets starts to make the rounds on social media, we have Majority Leader Jim Steinke shared it, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss as well. Voss's comment on there was, "OMG, we all stumble once in a while, but how can the media ignore this kind of stuff every single day?" So we thought it was something worth addressing to point out why this particular version of events really did not merit any kind of additional coverage, aside from, unfortunately, having to point out that it's a very widely shared piece of manipulated media. We also had a note along the way with this one. This was not the first time we had seen some misinformation or disinformation coming from Voss's Twitter account. In February, he had also shared a post created by the Wisconsin College Republicans that showed a sloppily edited series of images that implied Supreme Court candidate Jill Karofsky was tearing up the Constitution, basically pasting her face on the famous image of Nancy Pelosi tearing up the State of the Union speech. But back to the original Biden video here.
Let's pause right here. We're with Eric Litke, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. Want to hear from you. What questions do you have about after hearing lawmakers talk about Wisconsin's prison population or crime rates? What do you want to know about how the state's prisons or crime rates are affected? What kind of statements have you heard from lawmakers debating those issues? We're at 800-642-1234. So, Eric, speaking of Representative Voss, PolitiFact rated another recent statement by Voss half true. He claimed in a newsletter that Governor Evers wants to release half of the prison population. What has the governor said?
So this goes back to the campaign trail. In 2018, Governor Evers had told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that he would consider releasing some inmates early, taking other steps with the ultimate goal of cutting the prison population in half. Now, his description of this and later references by the correction secretary talk about this being a long-term goal, that this is something that needs to be done gradually and thoughtfully and deliberately. So it really comes down to, in this case, the definitions of release and reduce. So Evers is discussing a long-term plan. Voss changes that to say or imply this is something that's going to happen immediately, that they're basically going to swing open the doors and let half the people go. Ultimately, that's not at all what is being proposed by Evers or anyone else. So that's where we land with the half-true rating.
Speaker Voss cited that Governor Evers' comments while supporting a package of Republican bills seeking harsher criminal penalties. Let's look at another statement from that debate by State Representative Joe Sanfilippo.
Sure.
So FBI data shows violent crime rates increased in all but two Wisconsin cities between 2008 and 2017. In fact, when combining Wisconsin's 10 largest cities, the violent crime rate increased by 24% during that time, while decreasing by 14% on a national average.
Okay, so that was Representative Sanfilippo in a podcast describing more violent crime. What did you learn there, Eric?
So this is part of a series of statistical claims from Republicans backing a series of tough-on-crime bills. In this case, we found basically a masterclass in how not to use data. So we focused in on the first part of that, saying violent crime rates increased in all but two Wisconsin cities over the last 10 years or so. So first off, this references a time period that ended in 2017 when we have 2018 data available. So we're ignoring basically the freshest data. And in this case, that actually showed a reversal to some extent, that the violent crime rate in Wisconsin had dropped after several years of steady increases. This also essentially ignores the fact that the FBI warns us not to compare all of this data year to year. Not every police department reports their violent crime data each year. In many cases, there's going to be some local changes to reporting practices and definitions. That means that the definition of a crime in 1 year doesn't necessarily mean the same thing in the next year. So ultimately, if you go through and you look at the new data, you look at the data that should be compared, it paints a very, very different picture. So in fact, instead of only two cities where crime goes up, there's actually more than 100 Wisconsin municipalities where the crime rate did not rise over the last decade.
You looked at how much violent crime in Milwaukee affected that statewide picture. What did you find there?
Well, looking at Wisconsin as a whole without acknowledging Milwaukee as an outlier is really pretty fundamentally misleading. More than two-thirds of the violent crime in Wisconsin takes place in Milwaukee. So ultimately, any kind of statewide number is mostly just a reflection of what's happening in Milwaukee. So one of the other ways that we kind of looked at this data is if you use the new data, you use the stuff that the FBI says is okay to compare, and if you pull out Milwaukee, then that gives you a little more accurate picture of, okay, what is the violent crime picture in the state at large? And there you see almost no change. The violent crime rate across the other 200-some municipalities in the state across the last decade went from 1.77 to 1.74 per 1,000, so nearly identical numbers.
We have Eric Litke of PolitiFact Wisconsin working through recent statements by lawmakers, looking at numbers, FBI data, exploring what holds water, what doesn't. Are you tracking Governor Evers on any of his campaign promises? Which ones do you remember? Which campaign pledges do you want to see fulfilled? And how much weight do you place in lawmaker statements and their campaign promises when voting? Be part of this 800-642-1234 email ideas at WPR.org. State Cap continues with Eric Litke in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Eric Litke on the line from PolitiFact Wisconsin guiding us through lawmaker statements, explaining whether they're totally truthful, partially truthful, or not at all. Are you tracking Governor Evers on any of his campaign promises? Which ones stand out to you? And have you ever voted against a candidate because they didn't follow through on a campaign pledge? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And Eric Liedtke stays with us as our guide. Let's bring in Jim now, joining us from Dubuque, Iowa this morning. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I think people need to listen to as many different sources of information as they can, not just PBR or Fox or MSNBC or whatever. People tend to seek what they want to hear, and they tend to be gullible and ignorant. The one of the worst examples of taking things out of context was the frequently misused quote of Mr. Trump saying he can do anything he wants, which was taken out of context. That was relative to one particular decision that he made.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. Eric, Jim says, beware of echo chambers.
Yeah, and that's ultimately the calling that we think we have as fact checkers, is to get kind of beyond the spin and the fluff and get to source material, get to kind of the foundation of these claims. And I think that's probably a good template for a lot of people to use if they try to critically look at the world around them, not just, you know, what are people saying about this, but what do the documents themselves say, and taking the time to go back and seeing if you're being spun.
Well, let's bring in Mike now in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I was really, really disappointed when a Democrat comes in and signs a bill that sends people away to jail for 5 years with a felony for protesting, and as a result may have trespassed on pipeline land. And, you know, I feel that someday I may want to go out and protest because things are getting worse than they have in the past. And I think this significantly deters people from getting out and protesting and exercising their constitutional rights. And as this goes around, this is a law I think that was written by Alec. And it's going around to other states. And I think this starts to look a little more like something fascistic. And I'm really worried about this, and especially from the so-called Democratic Party.
Mike, thanks for the call. Eric, Mike's really concerned about free speech and the legislation that may impact it.
Well, I think it's interesting to reference the origin of the bills there. We kind of tend to assume that things that come up in the legislature may have originated there. There's been plenty of reporting that shows these kind of model bills put forth by special interest groups that ultimately make it into and through state legislatures around the country in nearly word-for-word form. There's an extensive USA Today series on this. So, again, yeah, a call to look closer at what's going on and who it originates from.
Well, let's move on to taxes. A couple statements on taxes that PolitiFact rated mostly false, starting with Governor Tony Evers.
Finally, I delivered on my campaign promise for a 10% tax cut for Wisconsin's family. The people's budget, together with Assembly Bill 251, provided more than $500 million in tax relief for working middle-class families. That's money back in your pockets, folks.
So that was Governor Evers back at his January State of the State address. Eric, where did you see issues with that statement?
So he makes kind of a general claim that he, quote, delivered on a campaign promise for a 10% tax cut for families. So what we did is we went back to his original campaign promise where he gave us a little more detail on what that means. So there's a 2018 press release where he says he's going to create a 10% tax cut for families with incomes up to $150,000. So that gives us a little more of a firm benchmark to say, okay, is it fair to say that he delivered on that promise? And ultimately, the latest projections from the State Department of Revenue show that he is pretty far short of that. Across the married filers with an income under that $150,000 mark, The average tax cut is going to be about 4.9%, according to the latest projections at the time we looked at this. And the 10% tax cut that he says was coming for everyone, really going to be coming for about a quarter of all filers under the current plan. So we rated this one mostly false.
We're talking with Eric Lickey, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. Still time for you to join in this discussion. Have you heard lawmakers talk about issues like crime or taxes and wondered whether those statements were true? We're at 800-642-1234. PolitiFact also gave a mostly false rating to this tax claim by State Representative John Nygren. He said the governor had, quote, proposed raising taxes on the agriculture industry to pay for expanded welfare programs. What did you find by researching that?
So this is a reference to the highly disputed manufacturer and agriculture tax credit. So under Evers' budget proposal, he was looking to address only half of that. He left the agriculture tax credits untouched and changed the manufacturing side of that with reductions that under his plan would have cut a total of almost $300 million in 2020. So Representative Nygren's office went through a legislative fiscal bureau memo that basically showed the manufacturers involved there have significant agricultural connections. So about a quarter of those manufacturing and agriculture tax credits went to manufacturers where agriculture products are the primary input. So it gets a little tricky in the logic of it, but ultimately he's saying that the governor is cutting agriculture income or hurting the agriculture industry. But his words don't quite line up with really how that went down in the budget. There were tax increases proposed that affected agriculture, but not actually tax increases on the agriculture industry, which we think is an important distinction, particularly since Evers went out of his way to say that there is not going to be a direct impact on agriculture.
And how do you make a connection between farmers and welfare programs in terms of funding?
Sure. So there's no direct link here. There wasn't anything that was earmarked in Evers' budget to say we're going to cut this manufacturing tax credit in order to boost welfare programs. But it's not out of line to put those two things next to each other. Broadly speaking, a cut in one area does affect the ability to be able to increase spending in another. The manufacturing tax credit is paid out of the general fund. The general fund is what is used to fund welfare. So we didn't drop the claim rating based on that part of it. The key was just exaggerating the element of the agriculture tax credit.
So here we are approaching the end of the legislature's session, first session after Governor Evers took office. You've been tracking some of the governor's campaign promises. Governor Evers pledged to raise no taxes and cut middle class taxes during his campaign. How has he been doing on that?
So this was kind of an 11th hour campaign pledge from the governor saying he would, quote, raise no taxes. When his proposed budget came out, he had a proposed gas tax. The legislature pulled that out, however. He did, however, also propose a whopping 71% tax on e-cigarettes. Republicans lowered that one as well, but it did stay in the budget. There were a few other kind of tax-related changes, but ultimately, his promise was to raise no taxes, and we see a proposal that he brought up and that made it into law that did, in fact, increase taxes. So in this case, we're not rating the intent, so like the gas tax that failed in front of the Republican legislature doesn't factor in. We're rating the results, but there was a tax that made it into law. So we rated that as a promise broken.
So with his background as state superintendent, Governor Evers pledged a lot on the campaign trail, more funding for education. Has he fulfilled those promises?
So his promise was to restore the former standard of two-thirds state funding for schools. So that basically two-thirds of their budget is coming from state coffers. And we've been in the ballpark of that. Most recently in 2018-19, the state paid about 65.4% of the K-12 costs. Evers' plan would have pushed that across the two-thirds barrier, but the final budget, once it made it through the Republican legislature, basically left that unchanged. So a little over 65% for 1920 and for 2021. So again, rating outcomes and not intent, we rated that as a broken promise.
Is there anything else, any campaign pledges you're keeping an eye on for Evers in with PolitiFact work right now?
Well, there's certainly a few dozen that we have kind of tracked through the process, and I think one of the others that was really central to what he was trying to accomplish was the promise for Medicare expansion. His promise was that he would take immediate action to accept federal Medicaid dollars. His draft of the budget did that, and it was really a pretty foundational piece, tapping into $1 billion-plus in federal funding to be able to balance that budget out. When the Republican legislature went through, though, they took that out, made a very different budget, and ultimately that's what Evers signed into law.
We got to end it there. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Litke is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Secretary Kevin Carr from the State Department of Corrections. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. On this Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Currently, as we know it, no staff or inmates in Wisconsin have tested positive for COVID-19, but criminal justice advocates are still concerned about a potential outbreak. Our prisons house more than 23,000 inmates. The Department of Corrections announced Friday that state prison visits are temporarily suspended due to the spread of COVID-19. So do you work in corrections? What questions do you have about the immediate prevention steps around COVID-19? What suggestions do you have to help keep state prisons safe? We're at 800-642-1234. Kevin Carr is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Secretary Carr, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate, and good morning to all your listeners. Thanks for having me again.
So we heard from Health Secretary Andrea Palm recently told lawmakers that you discussed preparations for an outbreak of COVID-19 as a state prison. What is your department doing right now to prevent an outbreak at one of your prisons?
Well, I just want to let you and your listeners know that the Department of Corrections has had pandemic plans for many, many years. We have a lot of past experience preparing for pandemic outbreaks, such as the one in 2005, which was the avian flu, and then 2009, we prepared for the swine flu epidemic. And so weeks ago, our staff took our pandemic plans, started reviewing them and updating them in preparation for this type of an event. There's a number of things that we have done to react to the situation and being proactive. We've stood up our emergency operations center last Friday to coordinate activities and communication throughout our agency. We have a multidisciplinary work group that meets daily, and then a separate senior executive leadership group that meets daily to formulate strategy and discuss updates throughout the agency. And then, of course, we're coordinating daily with other state agencies and the governor's office for communication and coordination of response and resources.
So there is a lot of communication going on, but specifically, what is in your pandemic plan and what goes into action at this point?
Well, we enhance the level of communication that occurs between leadership and our staff and the adults in our care. We provide education to those in our care regarding how they can participate in the effort to help keep themselves healthy and safe from the virus, and practicing all of the activities that we all, I think, should know by now as far as hand washing, social distancing, covering your cough, and those types of things. We've enhanced our site cleaning so that instead of cleaning and disinfecting common areas just once a day, we've increased that to a more than once a day. We do infection monitoring of all of our adults in custody so that we can try to monitor what's going on and stay on top of the situation. We do equipment monitoring. There are a number of other things that I could mention if you wish.
Well, can you just bring some more clarity to clamping down on visits and who can visit, who can't?
At this time, all visiting to our facilities is strictly limited to professional visits only. That would be lawyers and other social workers or people that have an absolute need to visit one of our adults in custody. Now, we're going to try to provide those visits on a non-contact basis initially, and then we're also ramping up our ability to provide not only professional visits but family visits by utilization of video and in increasing the number of telephone calls that people can make from our facilities.
When do you anticipate that inmates and their families will be provided those additional opportunities to connect over the phone or in video?
Well, over the phone, that's something that we're working out right now. Our telephone provider has offered to increase the number of free phone calls that our adults in custody can have. We're working out that arrangement with them as we speak, so I would anticipate that that's going to happen within the next few days. And then the video conferencing thing, I can't really give you a time frame on that because, you know, there's a lot of technology involved in that and acquiring the technology to actually put it in place. For 24,000 people is a lot, you know, is quite an undertaking. But that's our goal because if this pandemic and the situation that we're in extends, you know, as long as many of the experts predict that it will, we want to be able to provide those in our care with the most opportunities to stay connected to their families as we can.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about our state's prisons with Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr. You can join in. What do you want to know about how our prison system is preparing for COVID-19? What do you think of proposals that would increase the prison population through longer sentences? Are you a corrections employee? What challenges do you face in your job right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Secretary Carr, you've said the governor plans to release a plan addressing crimeless revocations this spring. How could the administration hope to reduce how often people on community supervision are sent back to prison for technical violations?
You know, there's a couple of ways that you can approach that. And one of the ways that we're looking at is we're taking a real good hard look at the current set of rules that those on supervision are required to adhere to. And we anticipate that there may be some modification in that area. Another approach that you can, and if you do that, that reduces the number of technical violations that potentially could occur. Another approach is to look at the category of offenders as far as nonviolent misdemeanors versus those accused of assaultive behaviors. And there's a lot of emphasis on trying to gain some movement in that direction as far as whether or not those folks need to be incarcerated at all.
And revoking parole or probation and sending a person back to jail for violating the terms of release, that makes up a huge amount of your all new prison admissions. Is that right?
It makes up a significant portion of our new admissions to prison. That's correct, Kate.
How do you want to see that come down? What type of legislation could make an impact there?
Well, you know, as far as crimeless revocations goes, obviously anything that we do policy level that could be codified in the law would be easier to not change by the next administration or future administrations that come into the governor's office. So obviously anything that we do that has a legislative component to it, we would love to see the support of the legislature endorsing criminal justice reform efforts that are going to actually lower our population in the long run. We didn't get in this situation overnight, Kate. We're not going to get out of it overnight either. It's going to take some time to reduce our population to the levels that the governor and I would like to see at some point in the future.
All right. Well, we're going to circle back now to COVID-19, bringing in Alyssa in La Crosse. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi. I just have two quick questions. With this being an ever-changing or rapidly changing situation, how exactly are the staff updating their prison population daily? And then also, what would quarantine versus isolation look like as to someone in a prison population? You know, is it going to be the 23-hour isolation, or what are we looking at?
No. As to your first question, we're communicating with our staff and the folks in custody almost daily. As we get information from the Department of Health Services or the governor's office or the CDC, we put up a new website, and I encourage everybody to go to it. It's our website that is our public website. There is a COVID-19 tab right on the front page. If you go to that page, you will see all kinds of updates that we are posting as we receive them so that the families and the general public can be well informed of what we're doing. And we're also providing that information to those in custody and our staff. Then you talked about quarantining. As soon as a individual starts to exhibit symptoms of COVID-19, that person will, you know, be isolated and then monitored for their symptoms, and a medical determination would be made as to whether the condition of the individual warrants external treatment and testing. Now, we would isolate that person from the other folks in their normal housing unit so that, you know, the risk of contamination is reduced.
We're talking with Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr about recent developments at our state's prisons. Wisconsin locked up more than 23,000 people in 2018. That number is expected to surpass 24,000 by the end of next year. What questions or thoughts do you have about state funding levels for the Department of Corrections? What questions do you have about monitoring COVID-19 in the corrections system? Be part of this 800-642-1234 email ideas at WPR.org. Back for more in a moment with Secretary Carr right here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the past couple decades, the Wisconsin prison population has ballooned. African Americans are also disproportionately placed under supervision and reincarcerated for supervision violations, according to DOC, the Department of Corrections. This month, wardens have been moved around and reassigned at six prisons, including Lincoln Hills. Are you a corrections employee? What challenges do you face in your job? Join in 800-642-1234. Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Charlie joining us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
So, I wrote someone up in management, actually two people, and now I'm being retaliated against. I can prove that I'm being retaliated against. Why is it so complex and convoluted to get any action?
So within the Corrections Department, Secretary Carr, how does it handle retaliation and the climate for employees?
Well, I would like to know a lot more detail about Charlie's situation, because obviously with the limited information that he's provided, it's hard for me to comment on his situation. But we have no tolerance. I personally have no tolerance for retaliation or discrimination concerning any of our staff and coworkers here at the Department of Corrections. You may not realize this, but I will tell you that under our administration, we just stood up and created an internal affairs unit that is something that is going to improve how long it takes for us to do investigations. It's specifically designed to deal with serious acts of misconduct by supervisors and staff. So we do have a very robust personnel system where people can file complaints of discrimination or retaliation, and they will be investigated. So, Charlie, if you have an issue, please follow the process, and I can assure you that the matter will be thoroughly investigated and a conclusion reached.
Charlie, thanks. Let's bring in Daryl now in Couderay. Daryl, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. Thanks for Mr. Carr being there. My question is, since your population is in a controlled environment, I was wondering if testing your population has begun yet, and if not, when will testing begin?
Well, we're subject to the same limitations regarding testing that the rest of the state is, especially those who are not in our custody at this time. And most of the testing is controlled by medical professionals and local health departments. So as I stated earlier on the show, we'll monitor an individual in our care, and if they exhibit the symptoms consistent with COVID-19, a medical professional will make the decision as to whether additional testing or external treatment needs to occur. I would like to assure the listening public out there and the loved ones of those of the folks that we care for in custody that we have 24/7 medical care that monitors the health conditions of the folks that we care for. And that's, just a little bit more than most people do have at home.
We're talking about Wisconsin State Prisons, the setup to COVID-19 with Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rick now in Eau Claire. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me today.
Sure.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. My question is, on the state level of corrections, say, I know I have a family member that's on Huber Law. I don't know what the protocol is for shutting down the jails or at the county level, but what would be done with the folks that are allowed to go out to work every day and return to the jail?
It's a great question, Rick, because, one of the things that we did on Friday was we started to notify all of the employers of the folks that we have on work release to inform them that, the potential existed that we would discontinue allowing folks to report to work based on the conditions that are present at our facilities and what's happening in the state. What we can afford to do is have folks from the external environment introduce the virus to our facilities, which is a controlled environment, because the folks that we have in custody are very vulnerable for a number of reasons, whether it's because of compromised health, age, and the inability for them to actually segregate themselves from the other folks in the facility. So we're very, very careful about that, and we want to use the utmost caution in order to protect the people that we care for.
Rick, thanks. Let's bring in Mike now in Stoughton with a question. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, good morning. Say, I haven't listened to the entire interview, but I wondered, my first question is, I've got, where I work, we have some gentlemen from one of the correctional institutions that worked with us, and I just wondered how, I worry about them being exposed to us, you know, that one way or another, somebody's going to get harmed here. Either the guys are going to get harmed, or they're going to bring something into our facility that's going to harm us. I'm sure that this is a consideration, but I just wanted to see if you could expand on that. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Secretary Carr.
Hi.
Yeah.
Just as I told the previous caller, we're very much aware of that situation, and we're going to make that decision on a case-by-case basis. As soon as we think that it's appropriate to discontinuing our folks going out to work every day. But what we wanted to do was give the employers a little bit of a heads up because, you know, if our workers are providing critical manpower to their operations, it would just be like if you were to walk in and tell your employer you're not coming to work for the next 6 weeks tomorrow. We wanted to give them an opportunity to plan for their absence and at least have a heads up as to what was going on.
We've talked before about the department's challenges to recruit and retain corrections workers in this economy. Is that continuing to be problematic for you?
It still is. Up until this recent event concerning COVID-19, the economy obviously was very good. The unemployment rate is low. And when those two factors come into play, jobs like working at the Department of Corrections aren't as attractive to the general public when you can make more money doing something that's less dangerous. But I think we have strategies in place to try to address our vacancy issue, and hopefully as we move forward, we've made some progress as far as wages go, but we just have not made enough. And as I said earlier regarding our population, we didn't get in the situation we're in as it pertains to wages overnight, and we're not going to get out of them. We've probably made up a lot of ground based on the compensation plan that was approved by the governor in the last budget, but we have a new budget coming up in the next biennium where I hope we can make more progress so that we can be more competitive with the private sector as it relates to the attractiveness of working for the Department of Corrections.
Secretary Carr, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to be with you again.
Kevin Carr is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. He was appointed by Governor Evers after the 2018 elections and later confirmed by the state Senate in October of 2019. Just ahead, we learn how a doctor's offices are handling COVID-19. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report. You're listening to the Ideas Network.